Welcome, everyone, to the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. I am Josh Beiser, the owner and lead writer. We got a great podcast for you this week. Join me or some guys from Yacht Club Games, the makers of the recently released Shovel Knight. And we've got the pixel artist, Nick Wozniak.
Hi, how's it going?
And one of the programmers, Ian Flood.
Hello, everyone.
Nick, Ian, it's great to have you guys on tonight.
Yeah, it's great to be here, I guess.
Yeah, great.
And I guess first off, congratulations on not only having a successful Kickstarter, but having some great reviews for Shovel Knight. I played it last week, and I wrote my review up, and I really enjoyed the game.
Yeah, thank you. It's been really, really positive, but like overwhelmingly so. I don't know. I have never had a game received with this much positive energy in the past, so this has been quite a trip for us.
Mm-hmm.
We're just hoping to do right by all of that. Like, if somebody draws a cool image, we're hoping to get it out there for everyone. If a YouTube video is up showing a weird part of the game, we want to, like, make sure we get that in front of as many people as possible. Like, there's a lot of messages coming in, and we want to make sure we're handling all of them. And that's been a fun part of the last couple of weeks.
So, for people who haven't heard of Yacht Club or Shovel Knight, could you tell us a little bit about you guys and about what Shovel Knight is?
Well, Yacht Club Games is a small independent team of developers, more about half a dozen or so. We were originally, a lot of us hailed from Way Forward Technologies, makers of games like Shantae,
The biggest recent? Well, we worked on Double Dragon Neon very recently.
Oh, cool. So. I like
it. Yeah, that was a good one. But they do a lot of stuff. They do a lot of, like, licensed titles from movies and, you know, they did a Batman game, they did a Smurfs game, they did, a bunch of other weird, you know, licensed titles, and we were
both
able to
big
do,
and small,
both big and small.
We all worked there in some capacity or another, but we broke off to do our own thing and form Yacht Club Games, and we've been doing it for about a year now. Shovel Knight is our debut title, as under the title Yacht Club Games, and it's a 8-bit, inspired, like, rose-tinted look at the NES days of old. It's a character-driven, like, platformer game where you play as Shovel Knight, and you're on a quest to defeat the evil Enchantress and defeat a whole arsenal of themed knights that are out to stop you.
I didn't know you guys worked at Way 4. I've been following those guys for the last few years. I know they also did the DuckTales remake. I remember they did Boy and His Blob. That was another one. That was a good one.
Sean Velasco, who's the director of Shovel Knight and here at Yacht Club Games, is also the director from A Boy and His Blob.
Yep. So, and I did some animations for that game as well. So
that is strongly in Yacht Club's DNA.
Interesting. Yeah. So you guys pretty much have, like, 2D gaming in your blood then, I take it.
Yeah, I'd say so.
there's lots of 2D games were made, for sure. So it was great to... Always a genre I love returning to.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess that brings up my first question then for you guys, and that's to do with 2D design. It's one of those interesting elements that it has really become its own genre. And even though technology has evolved, you know, we have 3D these days, first-person shooters and all that. So what attracted you guys to 2D design as opposed to creating, you know, traditional 3D games or what we're seeing in the mainstream market today?
Well, I think, if I may, the reason we originally embarked on it is because we knew it was something that we could do well.
Mm-hmm.
So we worked with games like this in the past. I've done some 3D games myself, too, but we knew that when we had our group of developers and we wanted to make a project like this, we wanted to focus on our strengths.
Mm-hmm.
And 2D is naturally what came about. But I think a lot of us are interested in the realm of 2D just because of it's easy to understand and pick up. It can still have tricky parts to it and, like, difficult to master. But, like, the action that you see on screen isn't bogged down by things like spinning a camera around,
mm-hmm.
or not getting, like, culling just right, or, like, not getting things in the way. It's a very, like, pure expression of gameplay, and I think that's pretty appealing to me.
Yeah, I think we knew from the beginning that we wanted to return to more of a simplistic kind of design of the game based sort of around our team structure. We're a pretty small team. There's only about half a dozen of us, so
mm-hmm.
you know, I did the pixel art because that's the only thing I could do
mm-hmm.
on top of, like, everything else that had to get done in the game. So the pixel art was we knew we wanted to do that from the beginning. You know, make it really, like, bare bones, basic NES style, because
mm-hmm.
we're not a big team. And so in order to do a 3D game, and which we have a lot of interest in doing in the future, we'd have to change the team structure a lot.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to go back to something that Ian said a few seconds ago, and that's regarding 2D design having like that pure essence or that pure design. So I think that's a very interesting point, something that I also believe in. I mean, I grew up playing, you know, NES, SNES, the whole deal, those genres. And you are correct that there is that sense that you can really, trying to think of the correct way of saying it, but it really does allow you to have an all-encompassing view of what's going on, and you really put the player's skill, I believe, in the forefront, especially in like older titles like Mega Man and Castlevania. And as you said, you don't really have to fumble with a camera. You don't have to worry about any like on-screen like weirdness. It's just, here's a challenge. You know, you're here. How do you get over here without, of course, dying?
Yes. Yeah. And I think you see, even when games do make the jump to 3D, a lot of the ones that are most highly regarded are ones that manage to make a game that presents a 3D challenge but strip away the stuff that could bog it down. Mario Galaxy is fantastic because the way it jumps from plane to plane and presents very strict challenges one after the other makes it feel like carries over the gameplay feeling of a 2D game, but in like a 3D world. And I think things like that is like a strong way to express it.
Yeah, another thing that makes that I always think of when I think of an NES game or an SNES game that really seems to resonate well with people is it's easily accessible. So like there's no reason or there's no barrier between me seeing the character and seeing what he can do and then me internalizing that and making it happen. So I can see that in the case of Shovel Knight, you can see the mobility is really simple. He's got just like, you know, three or four things that he can do.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, you're able to internalize that almost by just looking at it. And then just within a few seconds of playing it. And that's the kind of thing that that can happen in that happens mostly in 2D games because they are more simple. But that can also happen, yeah, in 3D games, like Ian was saying.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that accessibility, that immediate response, and you know, tight player control is really what appeals to us as a team for sure.
And I'm glad Ian brought up Mario Galaxy because that was an example I was going to talk about as well. It is such a great example of basically putting these challenges right in front of the player. And as you said, just presenting them in a way that it's easy to see, and then it just leaves up to the player to process how to get through the area. And that's something that we saw in Shovel Knight as well, as you guys pretty much went through and paid homage to a lot of classic 2D game design.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's definitely in there. We definitely have a lot of influences that are just sort of maybe not so explicitly stated, but in our brains, but they're just kind of out there. You know, we played a lot of games when we were kids. We play a lot of games now, and so that, you know, the past 25 years of our collective gameplay experience has definitely had an influence as we made the game.
Here's a gameplay question. I was thinking about saving this for later in the cast, but I think this is a great general conversation for you guys, and that has to do with the definition or the concept of old school. This is a term that we hear a lot these days. We hear like developers pitch it as the tagline for their games. We hear gamers, you know, say, I want to go back to the old school way of doing things. And it's one of those terms I think that can mean different things depending upon who you're talking to at the time. So since you guys, especially working at WayForward and at Yacht Club, working on 2D style games, when you hear the term old school, what does that mean to you?
Confusion.
Yeah.
Strictly from, you're right, like when people say that, they're usually, they think that means the complete package, but it usually only means a few things that that happen to fall in line with what they're thinking about. Like one thing we've seen on Shovel Knight, even though a lot of people called it like return to old school, when you get to like the death and retry system of Shovel Knight, it isn't old school. It's like decidedly not so. Once you die in the game, you return back to a previous checkpoint and you can re-challenge it again to hopefully get back what you lost. But there's no like die two times, get kicked out to the beginning of the level. There's no like major forced loss of progress and things like that. And when I think of old school, I guess, I'm not sure.
Yeah, there's a lot there. I mean, it's the old school, like retro, the same kind of term. It's very mimetic in its definition, so it's hard to say exactly what it is to one person because it always changes based on the perceived meaning of it. But yeah, what people are typically referring to is like crazy hard difficulty, and you know, it's really really tight controls.
It could be.
Yeah, but like that's what I'm saying. Yeah, it's like it could be any of these things, and so when you take on that moniker, you're like assuming a whole wealth of information. So I would say a big task of us during this campaign has been like saying, yeah, it's retro, but like here's what we mean by retro.
Honing it in.
Exactly.
It's, like, it's not all the last games you played over the last 20 years. It's like it's rose-tinted NES, which means it's an NES game that we're trying to take to like its most polished core. Rather than just saying like it's an NES game or it's a Super Nintendo game or anything
exactly,
like that.
Which is also why we didn't feel the need to like be completely bound by the NES's specifications or it's in widescreen because that makes sense to the gameplay and it doesn't have sprite flickering because that looks bad. So we made sure that we took that definition or we took that moniker of retro or old school and kind of made it our own. So hopefully when you play the game, it feels genuinely like it you know belongs in that category, but doesn't ape anything else too strong.
I usually say inspired by, and not it's not trying to be a game from that era. It's
right.
Trying to be the best possible like representation of that like group of concepts.
Exactly.
So school makes me think that it's all or nothing, like kit and caboodle kind of thing. It's like the entire package, old school, as opposed to something that's like retro inspired or anything like that.
Yeah,
I think that's a really good point about honing it in instead of it just being, you know, we're making a game just using design from 1988.
That's like so dangerous. Imagine if we put up a Kickstarter saying we're making a PS1 RPG. It's like you can't see me, but like I have a mixed look of like fear and also excitement. Like, wait a minute, is that? Like, is that going to be like awesome 2D art because it's like on its way out, or is it going to be like really bad polygons? Like, kind of good polygons.
Maybe it's in 2D. Maybe it's in weird 3D.
Maybe there's voice acting. Maybe there isn't voice acting.
Voice acting.
Is there going to be a CG cutscene only if it's Square inspired? Like, it's like maybe there'll be too many party members. That seems pretty likely.
Yeah.
So like just saying that like you think, because like when I think like, oh, the PS1 RPGs I play, there's like 10 of them, is way different than what another person is. And especially if you're somebody pitching a Kickstarter or pitching a game like any game, honing it in to make sure that you're being really focused with what you're trying to deliver is a big part of it. I just wanted to talk about PS1 RPGs, I suppose.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I have a post on the website that's probably going to be up this week about old school design. And one of the things about me is that, like you guys, I grew up playing all these really old school titles. I mean, Mario, Sonic, the whole deal. And
they were new school at the time, right?
Yeah, they were new school at the time. And to me, I really don't want to go back to that era. I like the era of save games and checkpoints and people not, you know, killing you with crazy difficulty. Like over the weekend, I was trying to play two other retro inspired games, Volgar the Viking. And I was watching footage of 1001 Spikes.
Yeah.
And I know people who probably love that stuff, and I'm looking and going, I don't want to do that. I grew up playing those games. Don't make me go back there.
I'm really glad that Shovel Knight and 1001 Spikes came out around the same time on the same platforms, just to fully represent, which is a good point, like old school, both Shovel Knight and 1001 Spikes represent both of those. It's like try and retry memorization where every inch counts, and like a game that's more focused on like the overall experience of like characters and advancing and things like that. I'm glad, first off, that there's a market for both of those, and like there's people that want to play both of those types of games.
And there's a lot of overlap in the general populace who's playing both of those games.
For sure. You're right that you're thinking old school, like I can't wait to die a million times, is like not what you're thinking about.
Yeah.
You're thinking about like maybe like cool power-ups and ice levels and underwater levels and things like that. It's weird to go in with that expectation and hit that wall where you're like, this isn't my old school. Like whose old school is this? Like, did somebody play games like this? I don't recall that.
Oh, I recall them. I remember Battletoads, and that's like painful scars for me there.
Don't play that.
Don't
game.
Remember Battletoads. But yeah, I'm with you. I bought on Wii U Virtual Console Dracula's Curse just this weekend.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, because I had $5 from the from a promo thing, and it's like, okay, yeah, I'm buying Dracula's Curse, and I love every minute of it, and I will never not love it.
Did you finish it?
No, I always stop around like the pirate ship.
Sounds about right.
I'm gonna beat it this time, man. Mm-hmm. Dracula's saying all the good to bad. That's officially what it says in the opening. I will not abide by it. Sorry, I feel like I'm getting off topic.
Yeah, and that's the thing about difficulty is another aspect that means a lot of different things. Shovel Knight is a challenging game when you get to like the layer sections, but then there's different types of challenge. Like we can look at a game like Super Meat Boy, where it is similar to 1001 Spikes, where it is about basically hitting your head against that wall until either you break or it breaks, and you figure out that correct pattern or that the correct motion or velocity that you need to get across the challenge.
Yeah, it's like looking, it's like throwing a million tries at it, and if one gets through, then that, like, that's fantastic, you did it.
Yeah, it's more like, about finding the route through that level.
It's theoretically possible that you beat this. and I think those are great, too. But yeah, for Shovel Knight's difficulty, that was probably the thing that we talked about the most during just regular design and iteration on the game. All the levels that we made, which we went around, we went back and forth on constantly, the discussion was always, is this too difficult? Like, what could we do? What could we do to make it clearer? What are we asking of the player? What did playtesters have trouble with? Like, we were constantly looking to tune that stuff and sand it down. We found small ways to give the player a little bit more of a wiggle room, so it's not as demanding. And most of that is represented in the relics and the sub weapons in the game. We didn't want to make a game that had like Zelda style lock and key sub weapons, like, oh, I got the boomerang, now I can open boomerang doors. we wanted the sub weapons to cover like a very necessary weakness for Shovel Knight, or provide a new opportunity for a player that might not know how to go through it with just like his basic attacks. And I think you see that more in Castlevania, where the sub weapons, like, oh, that's like fantastic. Like, right. I've always wanted to hit things 10 tiles above me.
Exactly. It solves a problem that you kind of already had. Like, mobility is clear and you know what your limitations are right off the bat. And so you know, like, oh, this thing does this. Like, this pulls me forward 5 blocks that I can see, you know, 8 instances where that I could totally utilize that to its full extent.
Yeah. And so now something that would be, that could be like very well seen in the same vein as 1001 Spikes, where it's like they're asking me to do something so specific, you actually have a few items, like a few tricks up your sleeve where you're like, I'm not doing that. And then you just pull out relic number 4 and you're like, you know, run by and smile. But I think providing the player the choice to make their own decisions about that kind of stuff is, goes a long way to not making the game feel like a crushing burden on their gameplay experience.
It also makes it way more exciting when you limit those choices they can make. When you have a hallway, like I'm thinking of the lowering platforms and the spikes above in Spectre Knight stage, where you can't jump, and suddenly that's a whole new challenge that you haven't really had to handle before, because, or, you know, rooms before that, you're jumping as much as you want, you're bouncing on things, get as high as you need to, and suddenly it's like, okay, now do you just short jumps or don't jump at all? And it's like a tension there. So yeah, like that there's a good balance that you can find with using the difficulty and using the just basic mobility to kind of challenge the player in new fun ways.
All right. Before we talk more about the game design of Shovel Knight, I do want to move and talk about the Kickstarter, as this was the general public's first introduction to Shovel Knight and you guys at Yacht Club Games.
Yeah.
So I'm pulling up the Kickstarter page now. Here we go.
All right. He's done it.
It's the final day.
And I have a few questions for you guys. These are some just general questions I like to ask everyone who comes on who's had a successful Kickstarter.
For sure.
So the first one is, did Kickstarter and crowdfunding basically influence development of Shovel Knight? In the sense that, were you guys developing Shovel Knight first and then go to Kickstarter? Or did you guys see Kickstarter and go, hey, this is a great idea, let's make a game to basically fund it through crowdfunding?
We were working on a game before Shovel Knight as Yacht Club Games for a good while, just on our downtime. And there was a certain point where we realized that it was not panning out, and it wasn't what we wanted to do. So we decided to refocus in and came up with the idea of Shovel Knight. And I believe that we, when pitching Shovel Knight to just the team, that we were intending to go to Kickstarter with it. It was like, what could we do as a team? What's like a reasonable time frame? At Way Forward, Sean Velasco was involved as a director, which involved a lot of like pitching of projects. Like, hey, like, you know, Mattel is here and they need a Barbie game. Like, what would that be? So he already had a natural developed knack for like scoping a project, like getting the details out there and communicating it to the team. To summarize, we knew we were going to be on Kickstarter when we started thinking about Shovel Knight.
Yeah, Kickstarter, as everybody has seen, has been pretty synonymous with the development of Shovel Knight. We've had a lot of just conversations with people, with fans from the very beginning. We've had as you guys all saw, the pitch was pretty detailed from the very beginning, and it, we had to, you know, as a result of throwing it out there, we feel obligated to not deviate from that too much. And so it definitely has had an influence in terms of making the content what we had originally intended, which doesn't always happen when you're making a game. Sometimes you make a game and you say it's going to have 12 levels and it's going to have this many enemies and the normal pitch stuff, and you cut that down during development, or you add to it, or it fluctuates. But with Kickstarter, you kind of feel like you're making this game for people, and you don't want to let them down or lie to them, and there's not the same understanding with like a publisher or somebody. So
you do want to let down. Just to be clear.
Yeah. So there's definitely a sense of more responsibility. Exactly. It's a lot more personal.
And I would say the Kickstarter also effectively, since we got put out in the public, we were put under the gun as well. Mm-hmm. It's not a project that could have just fizzled out due to disinterest. It's not something that we could just like play around with for another 2 years. We were like, it was our current project, and we were very serious about
seeing. And people are emailing us to get it out immediately.
Right, they want to know why it's already out.
Yeah, exactly.
So I would say, yeah, it definitely had an impact. It was like, it's like signing a project.
Yeah.
It's like an obligation.
Mm-hmm. And then logistically too, it was like having a Kickstarter, you have to respond to the comments. You have to talk to people. You're constantly doing things.
Apparently, you don't have to do that. Some people don't do that. Did you know that? They don't do that.
That sounds terrible.
Some people don't like that.
Yeah, I think that would be, that'd be bad.
What is the next one? Our 50,000 stretch goal, whatever the heck that means,
yeah.
is radio silence. It's like, you unlocked it, and then, like, live the excitement.
Like, there are other stretch goals, we just don't talk about it.
Live the excitement of not knowing what's going on behind the veil.
People are pulling their funds to get it back down below.
Yeah, I want to see what's happening. Who's the 2,000 backer? I would say it had a pretty strong effect.
Yeah, just on your day-to-day working on stuff, it's like you can either pixel this guy's face or respond to 13 emails.
But now that we've gotten the game out in America, we want to working very hard on the European and Australian release, and eventually the Japanese release. Once every Kickstarter backer has their physical reward and game, I will feel like a great relief just that we...
And Mac and Linux as well.
And Mac and Linux. I will feel a great relief that we delivered on what we wanted to deliver, and that everyone's like... I want everyone to be satisfied with Shovel Knight, like, as a Kickstarter project.
Right.
I want them to say, like, oh, that was truly excellent. Like, yeah, there were, like, some weird spots, or, like, yeah, I had to email them to, like, fix something, but, like, overall, like, I had a great time and, like, would back again just from a standpoint of providing an entertainment value and like an interest value for people who were willing to give us a shot.
Awesome. Now, in terms of getting on the Kickstarter and posting actual project for Shovel Knight, how far in development did you go into Shovel Knight before you took the Kickstarter?
Not very far. What you see on the Kickstarter demo or the video pitch, that's basically what we had at the time.
Yeah, we worked on it for a month or two to make sure it was all honed in. To get the gameplay concepted out and playable. That's all playable inside that trailer.
Most
of
it.
But that's all that we had, except the Tinker Knight.
Yeah, there's a Tinker Knight and the King Knight dialogue stuff. We had to mock up a little bit of that just because we wanted to focus on the actual, you know, building the game as opposed to like figuring out how to draw a giant guy or how to do dialogue systems. So, yeah, like what you see on the pitch video is pretty much what we had. And there's also, we were also developing the demo for PAX East, which was happening like the second week of our Kickstarter. And that was pretty much it. We wanted to make sure everything was, like, we front loaded everything. Everything was front facing. You have, we are pitching this game to everybody. So everybody needs to be able to see it in its full glory. And so it was really stressful to get that out there. But we wanted to make sure it was fast and happening as we were making the game.
Now, one thing that I noticed that's interesting about Shovel Knight is that, did you guys originally plan to release it not only on the PC, but on the Wii U and the 3DS as well?
When that Kickstarter went live, we were fully intending on this game coming out on PC, Wii U, and 3DS. We didn't have the final details until a few days into the Kickstarter, but I think our first update, which was like less than a week, was like, good news, it's coming to Wii U and 3DS.
Yeah, we were in talks already before the Kickstarter even went live. We just needed to have like final confirmation that we were Nintendo developers and that we could get the dev kits and all that.
Yeah, that is interesting because that's one of the things that we normally see with a lot of other Kickstarter projects is that they usually stick to one platform and then the additional ones are stretch goals. Now, I know you have the Mac Linux as one of your stretch goals.
Right.
Do you think having the initial or announcement about being on the Wii U and the 3DS, do you think that helped your Kickstarter at all?
Yes. I think there are a lot of people, well, first off, Shovel Knight appeals to a very specific generation of game playing mm-hmm. that I think is alive and well on the Nintendo platforms, not just in Virtual Console titles, but even Virtual Console, NES Remix and things like that, but also just the style of games that have that have grown up there and things like that. I would say that there's a very passionate fan base there, and the fact that we were on these prominent Nintendo platforms was a big draw for a lot of people, especially for it to be on a 3DS, a portable system, and a console. So both camps got what they would look for, which is a ready to go game or a sit at home kind of game.
It was also really important for us just as a team developing the game. It's a Nintendo game at heart, so we wanted to make sure that we were on those platforms, and that was something that we pursued full force. We really wanted to be on Nintendo for sure.
And as there's also a really good reason for developers to put stretch goals for additional platforms, which is that they are serious undertakings that mm-hmm. can't be totally. It would obviously be great if everything was on everything, but it's still a serious amount of work. For us, I've released titles on Wii U and 3DS before. We all have pretty much. Mm-hmm. So it was less of a unknown for us and more of a thing we knew, we scoped it and we knew what we could do. So we figured we might as well go for it because that's one of our strengths.
Okay. And as a quick aside, I'm curious, in terms of sales numbers, has Shovel Knight been doing better on the Wii U 3DS or has it been doing better on the PC, or is it too close a call at the moment?
I don't have the exact details right now. I think it's doing pretty, fairly even overall, just when you look at the sales. There's none that's an explosive outlier itself, which is good. I'm glad that that means that everyone's getting the game that they that they want to get.
Yeah, and all those platforms are viable.
Yeah.
There's a tendency, I think, for people to think that just like Steam is the only place to go because that's the only place where you can sell a game. But we've seen that that's not true.
Mm-hmm. Especially with a game like Shovel Knight, because as you just said, it is a game that appeals to that old school, the fans who grew up playing the 2D platformers, and that is still one of the main areas that Nintendo likes to develop games for. We see a lot on the 3DS, Kirby, Yoshi, the whole deal.
It's nice to be alongside that library of games for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So another question for you guys regarding the Kickstarter. Were there any elements or things that you felt that you guys did really well in terms of getting Shovel Knight out there and on the Kickstarter platform?
I think our fan engagement is pretty high. That's such a boring biz dev term. I'm sorry I used it. But what I mean is Woz has been hand responding to every Kickstarter comment on the page since the very beginning. We respond to email and Twitter. We try to be as obsessive as we can about it, just to make sure that anyone who wants to get excited about Shovel Knight, that we can show appreciation for that. So that was one. I think our updates, this all sounds complimenting ourselves, but I think our updates and what we've provided and what we've tried to get out there have been pretty consistently good. I'm happy with what we've been
doing. And the pace at which we set it out was also good. I mean, there's a temptation to throw a bunch of information all at once, and we were able to drip feed a lot of that content throughout the entire month and without totally killing us. I mean, it was really a tough amount of work to get all that done, but we were able to do it. And then I guess another thing that we did is we didn't set the expectations too specifically and too high for Shovel Knight. I mean, they were definitely high in terms of just what was initially pitched, but we didn't promise, online multiplayer, or we didn't promise certain things that would have just completely blown out the that would have been a single module of the game that would have blown out the production by months or something. So I think we have that because we have shipped games before. We have a lot of experience just knowing what the limitations of our team is, but also what is expected from a game. A lot of teams out there right now who are I think Kickstarter is their first game that they've ever made and they've ever finished.
Don't do that.
Yeah, that's so scary to me. I have no idea how that gets happened.
There's already enough to think about. Don't worry about people publicly trying to figure out what you're doing with money.
Yeah.
All right, and as a follow-up to that question, were there any areas of the Kickstarter that you felt that maybe you guys didn't do the best on, or, you know, using or with hindsight, you would go back and do it differently?
Yeah, there's a couple areas I can think of. I think that our initial like buy-in price is too low. I mean, we're selling the game for $15 now, but it was available for $10 on Steam initially. Mm-hmm. There was a couple of snafus with us understanding how Steam worked. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to say that, you know, that you could, like, it's hard to say that we should have done something totally different because there was just so much of a learning process involved here that it really, like, it got us to where we are, and just being honest with the people as we made mistakes was good, and you know, trying to hard to avoid mistakes as we went. Yeah, it's hard to say that any one thing could have really helped us out or changed things for the better if we had changed them in the past. I don't know, can you think of anything that really was a pitfall for us that we should have done differently?
This is just in the 30-month period?
I guess, or just like the whole thing. Because, like, yeah, Kickstarter was like where we got the whole game's production out of it.
Nothing that's like too out there. There's like minor improvements that could have been made, like how we handle, you know, all the emails or something, but nothing like terribly exciting that I can think of. We definitely made mistakes, though, to be clear. Like, mistakes were made and lessons were learned every step.
Yeah, but you're supposed to make those mistakes. Like, mistakes are supposed to happen. That's sort of what I'm trying to get to, is, like, you make mistakes so you can learn and you grow, and it's sort of expected that you're going to kind of mess up every now and then. Yeah, but
we tried to, like, heal over all of them.
Right.
Like, just to, like, do better. When we went to PAX, like, we talked about that big, important PAX demo, which was during the second week of the Kickstarter. And for those, you know, those 3 or 4 mysterious days when we were out, like, with out working the show floor with, like, our busted feet and, like, aching shoes, we didn't answer Kickstarter comments at all because we were busy. Like, we were spending pretty much our entire lives talking about Shovel Knight. And then we got, like, we were starting to head back, like, we're packing. And it's like, guys, people are really mad because we haven't responded all weekend about Kickstarter. And so I remember Waz was sitting on the terminal floor of the airport, furiously responding to as many comments as possible. Like, yes, thank you. Like, sorry, that's so great. Oh, that fan art's really great. Hey, I'm sorry, but the box is only going to come if you pay at, like, this tier. Okay, thanks. Like, see you guys in a week.
That was pretty cool.
And it was just, like, a furious stream of, like, we're sorry.
Yeah, we were very stressed. We're such pretty thin. We didn't have somebody at home answering emails, which I guess could have worked even now.
How dare we?
Yeah.
but seriously, but also, how dare we? It was a 30-day period where we were promising that we would be with you every step of the way, and so to step away like that is not fair to the backers.
To the majority of people who aren't FX. So
But people that want to see it succeed, that want to ask questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hopefully that, I mean, luckily that
next
was...
Next time, let's just buy all of our backers PAX tickets.
Yeah, there you go. Problem solved.
Or unlock the radio silence stretch code.
Yeah, that sounds like a great idea.
What you really need to do is you have it at 200,000, then at 300,000, remove radio silence. There.
Oh, yeah, that's perfect.
Yeah. Now you're thinking, okay, wait, I want to change my answer about what we could have done differently.
All right. And before we talk a little bit more about just the general crowdfunding, the development, one final question for you guys regarding the Kickstarter itself, and this is another question that I like to ask all developers we have on, and that is regarding the future of crowdfunding from your guys' point of view. One of the things that we've seen over the last 2-3 years is the explosion of Kickstarter and crowdfunding, and now we're sort of seeing somewhat of a decline, but maybe a maturation of the platform. And there's this general debate going on whether or not crowdfunding will remain viable and sustainable in the future for game developers. So my question for both of you is, in your opinions, do you feel that crowdfunding as a platform will remain viable for game development?
I think it's definitely getting more competitive. It used to be that if there was a good game up on Kickstarter, like, it would seem like it was like a surefire hit and that it was going to fund. But now it seems like there's an extra level of like muscling in on it, mm-hmm. where even a great game that, like, it's like, I can't believe this isn't funded yet. And that's because there's like 5 other great games that are going that month.
Yeah.
So it's definitely getting a bit more competitive, or at least that's what it feels like just watching from the outside.
It's also hard to say that it's totally viable right now for just general game development, because the budgets that are being allowed on Kickstarter at this point are very small. It's hard to communicate that with the general public.
A couple million is small.
I'd say like it's small for like Mighty Number 9. That's like a big giant Kickstarter. That's a big deal for people. But like if that's $4 million being used, or about $4 million being used to fund a company as big as Inti Creates or and Concept together, and along with 8-4, like there's a lot of companies involved. It sounds very like that money will be stretched thin pretty far. So just seeing budgets in the past and we're going through that and seeing how a $300,000 project looks in another company, it's hard to say that this is a very it's not a thriving thing that is sustainable right now. But I think it's a good way for people to jump in as smaller teams. Like I don't think a mid-range company could use Kickstarter to the same effect that
they could on the regular.
On the regular. There are exceptions, of course. I mean, Star Citizen is a huge example of that. Or I mean, and I'm sure Concept and Inti Creates are doing well with what they have. But it's rare that a game does really 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 well, or any project does really like super high numbers. Especially those that are the norm.
So you're saying it's being subsidized by like other elements of development.
Yeah,
it's doing pretty well, but also like they're putting in this amount, or they're relying on like the existing.
Yeah, or there's a period of time where the company's just not paying its employees or something. Like there's a general like understanding of like Kickstarter is.
It's a Kickstarter, guys. So like let's all like you know tighten the belt and like make this happen.
Exactly.
Like make it happen for our dreams.
Yeah, and so that's not necessarily to say that it's going to fail in the future. I'm just saying that, like, I think that this general understanding that Kickstarter is a way to, like, start something off to kickstart it, per se, it will continue.
So that's one of the challenges that they face is, like, finding, stabilizing it, finding normalcy.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I think you brought up a good point regarding budget constraints and how the general public perceives, like, what would be a budget of a video game, was we're seeing a lot of Kickstarters with incredibly varying amounts of, you know, pledge or, you know, what they're asking for. We see, you know, someone asking $50,000, someone else is asking, you know, $250,000, and then there's people, as you said, that could be asking for millions of dollars, and it's hard for the general public to realize just how much that goes into game development. There's a big difference between making something like Shovel Knight, as opposed to, you know, saying, hey, let's make an open world, you know, fully explorable RPG. We're only asking $100,000. You know, that's never going to happen.
It's extremely difficult because everyone, even if you're like, you're doing your best, like you're poring over every Kickstarter and analyzing the budgets, like, is this worth this and that? You're still dealing with so little information when it comes down to it. Like, oh, how'd that open world game come together? It's like, because they had like an angel investor on the side, or because they were working, like, because they didn't pay anyone for a year and they just got it out because they wanted to. There's so many like small details like that that completely throw those estimations out the window.
Right.
So to decide something like, is Shovel Knight worth are four Shovel Knights worth a Mighty Number 9 that's the most useful information you can start drilling into, but it's not helpful, and it's like it's easy to get lost in it for a lot of other things. Like you saw this when like Mighty Number 9's getting voice acting and things like
right.
Some people said like you could get voice acting for free, so it should all be free, or voice acting should be like the most expensive thing. Like just because you think it could be priced at something, you assume that's what they're going to get, and there's just a lot of details that are just not understood yet. But I think for each project that comes out and each time people are following it, I think more and more of that information is getting out there, and hopefully if crowdfunding is going to become the norm, maybe people are going to start to become more comfortable with what we're dealing with here. Like Skullgirls had a big outcry for their budget, but then they broke it down, and I now think most people like are starting to like understand. It's like, yeah, okay, that's probably based on how they were doing it, that like makes sense. That's how much it would cost, and now they're taking that information into the next year, into the next Kickstarter. So like that information is slowly building up, and I think that's an important part if crowdfunding is going to become an accepted part of just developing.
Yeah, there's a general trend of just the public being educated as things come up. Like you're understanding new and new aspects of the game that like you never saw before.
Right.
You know, like nobody has ever seen. When I started working in a game company, I had never known what a budget was. I didn't know what it took to actually make a game.
Mm-hmm.
And we're starting to see the breakdowns for that. I mean, most of that money just goes into people. Like it's time of somebody working on the game.
And so when you start to think of it that way, and you start to break down the budgets for in terms of how that works, then it starts to make a lot more sense.
It's weird. Depending on where you happen to navigate to on the internet, it feels like there's more discussion about a game's budget than it is their gameplay or graphics when it comes to like certain elements of crowdfunding. Yeah. And that's like maybe out there somewhere, there's a guy who's as into the business management of games more so than like somebody who's into like the programming, the jump physics, and he's having like a heyday right now. He's like loving all this, like all the stuff happening. Like, what, they could do that for 20,000 kind of thing. I think like all the discussion that's happening out there is great, and as people are bouncing ideas off each other and things like that, then more people can learn about how the amount of work that goes into this kind of stuff. I think the difficult part is to balance the weird feelings that people form over it, which is like, I can't believe they would even pay that much for this. Like, now this like game's a scam, or something like that. Like, there's a clear like cliff where some people jump off and decide like, never mind, like red flag, it's over. And hopefully we can try to press developers for when we think there's not enough information, but not like pull the fire alarm when it's just a normal situation that happens every day. But I guess that's a larger thing. We've never had any problem like that on our project, so maybe I'm just channeling what I think developers feel when they look at some other things.
I want to touch back on something you mentioned, Ian, a few seconds ago regarding how these outside factors can sort of influence what the people are seeing or the perception of the project. And one of the major ones, I think, is the concept of stretch goals, or what happens when a project gets overfunded? Because we've seen debates about this in the past. You know, when a game was only asked $25,000 and maybe pulls $100,000, people expect to say, you know, hey, you earned this amount of money. What are you going to do with the game differently now that you got all this extra money? Or when you start adding stretch goals, people start to feel like, you know, if you're not changing the game to suit the profit or suit the pledges, that, you know, you're just going to take this money and run away with it. Right, and that's another issue that is that kind of causes debate among a lot of Kickstarter or crowdfunding pledges regarding, you know, what happens to that additional money, or, you know, once the project is funded, should everyone just stop funding it altogether? You know, there's a bunch of weird questions and debates there.
I think that goes back to having weird feelings about things. There are some people that will decide outright, and I've seen it happen, it's like, oh, like, cool indie space game sold 10,000 copies, it's like done, pirating it forever. Like, essentially they say they've made enough money.
Right.
Or like something like that. Like, they, like, that's it. Like, it's a crap. I've heard people say it's a crowdfunded game, so they should give it away. like things like that. So I think there's a lot of like, people are thinking through the problem for the first time, or like for the second or third time, and they're trying to form their stance on it. But right now there's like, there are some red flags out there. There are like things that can contort that vision. And that's truly difficult to work through. But as far as the specifics of what you were saying.
Yeah, it's a little bit weird because when you pitch the game, you pitch it at the budget you think is going to get funded, and you also pitch it at what you can do. And any extra money, you know, people will think, well, okay, if you ask for 25 and you made 100, obviously you're going to make 4 games, right? But, I mean, what you're thinking is, what the developers are thinking instead of that is, great, we asked for 25, we made 100. Now we can spend a lot more time in the game. And that time, that money really just equivalents the time of the employees working there. And so when, polish time comes, or when times to iterate on design happens, like that's where that money is going.
But it's also like, it's part, the stretch goal element is a part of the Kickstarter experience in general.
Right.
And that's like things, it's an exciting part. Like, the game that you already liked can possibly get more exciting. Some people fundamentally hate the idea of that. They just want it to be like once the game's reached, like everyone calm down. But for a lot of other people, they signed on to this project to hear every like new detail. Mm-hmm. Like, stretch goals is an exciting, like, it's an exciting part of the end part of the project where a lot of new things can come online, or a lot of things like that. It's difficult to balance, because if you put things up there and you don't reach it, then it's a disappointment to everyone. Mm-hmm. If you put up there and like you blow past all of them, then you have to make more. If you commit to like things that truly throw the development off, mm-hmm. then that could be like, that's a bad decision that hangs with you for the rest of the project. Mm-hmm. So
Yeah, I guess like there's different kinds of people who are coming to a Kickstarter. There's those that are there for the excitement.
Thrill seekers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, and you'll then like jump onto a project, you're really excited and really active in the forums, and then just disappear after the Kickstarter's done. Because it's like, all right, show's over, like I can go home now. And eventually I'll get a game or whatever.
Send me the Steam key when it's done. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that happens a lot. And then there's others that are like really invested in seeing this fall through, and so they or follow through, and so they've like been with the development through the whole time. Yeah. And so yeah, there's definitely a large like spectrum of people out there that are you know, playing the Kickstarter game.
Yeah, I think it's cool that stretch goals exist for projects that want to make use of it. But I would also like, what was it, do massive chalice, not do stretch goals or something like that, in an effort to slow it down. And I totally respect that too.
Yeah,
I don't think it's a necessary part of a campaign, but I think it can be an exciting part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a good point regarding the stretch goals, because I've spoken to developers like that who say that, you know, we didn't want to do stretch goals because we put everything we had into that project. And then there's the other side where, as you said, stretch goals can be sort of like that deciding factor or that energy that can push a Kickstarter forward and up and beyond what you were initially hoping for.
Yeah, if your project has room to grow, like, man, I would like it on the beta. Like, what would it take to get it on the beta? It's like, well, probably like enough money to pay somebody to do it. If that's something that's like naturally is a destination that you want your game to take, then that sounds like a good stretch goal. If you wanted like a battle mode and you could do it with a little bit more time and money, then that sounds like a good stretch goal. Mm-hmm. If you have a developer, if you're a developer that has like a really straight idea of what you're doing and you like, you think the pitch completely covered it and you have like no more ideas that you want to add to the game, you want to like leave it as it is. Like I pitched checkers and there's like, there's no way, like you guys can keep putting money into that PayPal account, but like I can't add anything to checkers. You're like, you're disrupting my pure vision. Then that's okay. Like, I think you could add cool new pieces to checkers so that they're rocks or they're spaceships. But if you think that that is, like, not a part of your game, then, like, that's just something, that's something to say and something I hope people respect.
And it's up to the one of the developer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Who's back to checkers on Kickstarter?
Okay, so with that, let's move from Kickstarter. And I have just a few more general questions for you, and then we'll get into the actual development of Shovel Knight. One thing that I'm really curious about, as you guys mentioned at the start of the cast, you originally started out at WayForward, which was primarily a console and handheld developer. Right. With you guys moving to Yacht Club, has things like changed at all in terms of making the game for the PC or dealing with the PC audience versus your regular audience of console and handheld gamers?
Yeah, Ian's had to deal with most of that in terms of just like talking to Steam community members and expectations of PC players.
Yeah, I mean, we've worked on games that have PC versions, like strictly for development and things like that. Mm-hmm. I've never worked on a game that had PC launch deployment like that. The scariest part for us was just making sure that the game was right on that platform,
yeah.
That it was like, it was at home. That was like a big concern for us. So, like we knew what the expectations were for playing a game on the Wii U and the 3DS. It's like, yeah, you need to like, the menus work like this, the pause menu, you should be able to like switch between the screens, things like mm-hmm. that. The PC, like, we wanted to make sure that no one's day, first day playing the game would be ruined by just like an option we didn't think about. It's like, oh, it's great, but I have like 18 monitors plugged in, so like, what are you going to do about that?
Yeah, it's not like we don't play games on the PC, but I think like the only people that really understand what PC gamers are expecting are people that have released games or products to the PC market, because mm-hmm. there's just no way to survey thousands of different
I play PC games, but I'm not a tinkerer.
Exactly.
Like, I don't like going into INI files to adjust the field of view just to, like, to play the game how I want to.
Right, right.
So, we're afraid we had blind spots, so we tried to do, like, beta testing with, like, some friends and, nearby family. So I guess preemptively making sure the PC version was at home and that we could properly fix problems if they came up was a primary concern for us, for sure.
All right.
Weird, because that's the, like, the PC was the version we used the most during development, just
right.
because it's mm-hmm. the ease of creation was so quick. But to think that it was also the one we were least sure about, just in terms of, like, whoever is running it on whatever system.
Yeah, it's pretty ironic.
It's a cool, I don't know.
I think that's an interesting point you brought up, Ian, regarding, like, that tinker aspect that we see a lot of PC gamers, because I'm pretty much, I think, the same way as you, that I like to play a game, and I don't want to mess with that stuff. I just want to sit down and enjoy the game. Like, I'll update my video drivers, I'll do that, but I know guys who will go into those files and they'll tweak every little aspect of, you know, get the perfect frame rate, they'll make sure the resolution is exactly how they want. Right.
And more power to them. I mean, I remember this weekend I booted up Street Fighter 4, the new Ultra one, and I have a television that has, like, bad save frame, so I had to move it around, and you can move around the HUD elements to, like, move it in or out, and I didn't feel comfortable viewing that.
Yeah.
It's like, is this where the Super Mario should go? I don't know. Like, where is it on the arcade? I don't want to, like, is it below Chun-Li's
speed? That's super weird.
Yeah, so, like, I don't even feel comfortable moving HUD elements on a fighting game. So when it comes back to PC, and, like I've installed mods, and, like, but usually I install mods that somebody else has vouched is a complete package.
Right, you're not going to do it by yourself.
Yeah, this is like Thor's hammer mod for Skyrim. It's like, don't worry, like, you'll find the hammer here, and you can, like, fly around and do cool things with it. And it's like, okay, great, this sounds like an encapsulated thing. But I would never install, like, here's a bunch of half-finished things I made. You'll have to spawn it in the console and, like, tweak it until it doesn't crash.
Yeah, we're even down to adjusting the field of view. Like, that happens a lot, and it's like that. Like, that seems weird because that totally alters the vision of what the game is going to look like for the entire time you play it. Right. But you can do that in Minecraft, and it just, like, feels so weird to me.
It's definitely a game. But it also goes back to, like, Shovel Knight as a NES-inspired game implies that there's not a lot of room for freedom there, just in terms of, like, when I boot up a Mega Man version, I'm not, like, expecting to, like, adjust how much health he gets hit for or anything like that. We didn't have to worry about that front. There wasn't as many min-maxing to go on in the gameplay. But things like hardware, controllers, things like that, we wanted to make sure we had buttoned down.
Now, another aspect of moving from console to PC would undoubtedly be the sort of how the PC market has adopted digital platforms and digital clients as the framework or as their platform of choice. Like, we talked about Steam a few minutes ago with how you guys got on there, but as traditionally working on the consoles and the handhelds, what has it been like to experience, you know, the joy and possibly horror of trying to get on Steam or, you know, working on this platform and making sure that this is where you want your game to be for your audience?
I mean, other than going through the strange experience that was Steam Greenlight, we were very fortunate to be greenlit during the Kickstarter campaign, which was a huge amount of stress just taken off our shoulder, because we didn't have to say, like, you'll get the PC game, but if we get Steam, we'll also send you a copy. We were able to say, like, we're coming to Steam. As far as, like, working with the platform, it's surprisingly easy to work with. It was great for delivering, like, limited beta builds to a few friends to try it on different platforms. There wasn't a lot of, like, strict requirements. It got out of our way and let us do what we wanted to do.
There's some pretty easy guidelines and walkthroughs of getting your storefront ready and stuff, and that was really helpful for me as I put that art together. So that was I'd say this Steam experience is pretty positive.
Now, another aspect of Steam that has sort of changed how games are being developed or how they're being perceived was sort of the adoption of not only achievements, but also the big trading card phenomenon. And while achievements are on the consoles, trading cards and digital items are still pretty much localized on Steam or on PC gaming. So another question for both of you is, as moving also to the PC platform, what are your thoughts on how the digital items sort of have become this huge deal for a lot of people?
Well, personally myself, I haven't really bought into that whole phenomenon yet. I like having cool backgrounds on my images and stuff, but I usually find those online in, you know, whatever format I find them. So I haven't really, like, got into that craze. And so it was a little weird, like how do I make a card that's exciting to somebody, and how do I make a background that'll work for a Steam background? As I was doing it, I was realizing, oh, this is cool. Like, oh, I can totally see why this is awesome. Oh, wow. Yeah. Like, this makes an icon that I can use in forums and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so it was interesting to kind of, like, be exposed to it from the other side, as it were. So it was really fun. And we knew that we wanted to make sure that Shovel Knight was at home on whatever platform it was on. So that's where we did the Miiverse and the Street Pass and, you know, the stereoscopic 3D and the 3DS. But we want to make sure that even when you're on Steam, that you're experiencing it in the same way that you would experience any other game on Steam, or the best games on Steam. And so having the trading cards was important and was definitely something we thought about from the beginning.
I think conceptually they're pretty neat, which is, as opposed to achievements where it's a very specific challenge you need to, like, man up and figure out, the trading cards are a reward for playing the game just playing the game. I remember when they first came out, I'm like, okay, so I get cards are playing Portal 2, and I boot it up. It's like, what am I going to do? It's like, I guess I can play like some of the community maps. I haven't done that in a while. And like, I'd run through it, and I got like 5 cards, just like, you know, messing around with the interface and playing through a few maps. So that like, that stressless way of rewarding people for just engaging and playing the game is pretty neat. What's happening with like trading cards and people thinking like, oh, I could buy the game for $15, but I could sell the cards for like $2. So it's like really 13. That's like a discount. That part's a little weird to me right now. Like, I think that's part of the Steam like high stakes metagame that I don't fully understand. I was pretty surprised to find that when we gave out early review codes to press people, that they sold our cards for like $1 to $2 a piece.
Nice.
to I don't know, like make back their investment of zero nothing.
Yeah, that was pretty interesting, definitely. Like Ian is saying, it's sort of like a different kind of achievement that's a little bit less, you know.
Achievement, played the game.
Yeah, exactly.
Like the best achievement that there is. Yeah,
exactly.
So I think it's a cool idea, and I'd love to see, like, if this is the first step of it, I'd love to see where it heads, or if it's like the final execution.
Yeah, the whole trading card phenomenon is something that I hear differing things from Peel about that as well, Nick. I have a few people, like my co-host, who is sometimes on the cast. He is completely and utterly obsessed with Steam trading cards.
Oh, it's great.
he tells me that he bugs his friends. He bugs me a few times as well for trading cards. I just close down, so he knows not to ask me. There's this whole, like, when you get, like, as you said, like, the high stakes or the high metagame of Steam, like, there's a freaking economy for these digital items. I know someone else who's made like several hundred dollars off of Team Fortress items, or they sell their cards for like $5-$10 a pop. And
dude,
then when
cards is going for 8 cents, it's like
eight
what?
Cents.
It's like it's down to 8 cents. You can get Wilson for 8 cents. Now buy.
Yeah.
It's like, and then I flip those over to like, I don't know, like Team Fortress 2 cards, and I can sell those for $1. It's like I'm gonna like spend all week on this, I can make like $5.
Yeah, and I'm just sitting here, like, the most I've made on a car is, like, 8 cents. That's, like, my big sale. I'm like, he's just, oh, I just sold a car for $50. And I'm just sitting there going, oh, you son of a bitch. Why is it not me?
I kind of like that you can jump in at different levels. Like, for me, I just, if I have half the cards and I have, like, a lot of cards I don't care about, I'll trade them and finish the badge. And I'll think, like, yeah, I finished the badge. For some other people, they might be like, I'm going only for the rare cards, or I'm going to get enough money to get this $15 game called Shovel Knight for free. And like, that's my weekend mission. But for me, like, my weekend mission is maybe to watch Netflix. So I think it is cool that there's different levels of engagement, even on the Steam, like, hyper trading meta community.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and it's kind of insane, really, how this has become its own economy. I remember, again, I get to show my age. I remember when Steam was still this, you know, crazy and weird thing, you know, Team Fortress wasn't free to play, and no one thought this was going to work, you know, PCs were going to die, that whole deal. And now it's completely reversed. And I remember people saying, you know, Team Fortress and, like, digital items, this was, you know, the death of gaming. This was it. It was never going to take off. And now we got those people, you know, selling cars. He says, like, the stock market, you know, buy low, sell high.
Were you there for the launch of Steam?
I was. I remember getting it for Half-Life 2. And
okay,
like,
great.
And then at that time, yes.
I remember when Steam was the weird server client that they replaced Counter-Strike's OneNet with.
Exactly.
And it's like, why do I have to load up this new thing, OneNet worked in the game? This is the death knell of gaming.
Yeah.
I can't believe it. It's so slow and terrible, and it's only launched 2 games that already worked off it, and like Half-Life 2 isn't even that good. Steam's the worst thing I've ever heard. Is like, that's what my entire LAN party group was saying.
Yeah.
So it's always funny to go back and forth on that.
Yeah, and I remember that too, like 2000, I think it was 2003, 2004, I was like, this is horrible, I don't want this. And like, I installed for Half-Life 2, then I uninstalled it, and then I didn't touch it again until like 2007, 2008, when my friends were like saying, you gotta try the orange box, you know, Team Fortress is great, like, do I really want Steam again? And then I installed, and then it's been like attached at the hip to me ever since.
Right, it's a natural part of the video game computer.
Yeah, I think I had a Steam account like a long time ago, but I never did anything with it. And very similarly, yeah, the Orange Box got me back into it, where it's like, hey, maybe you should check out all these other games. And then it was like, wait, they have sales? And then it was like, wait, oh god, my library exploded.
I still have played none of those games.
Exactly.
I played 5%, and I'm proud.
I can't do that. I still, when I go to the Humble, like when the Humble bundles are up, there could be like 4 games I really want to play out of 8, and I'll think like, nah.
That means 4 games I'm not going to play.
That means 4 games that I'm going to feel bad if I don't play. And then I'll either buy like the 2 I really want to play from someplace else, yeah, but I won't buy the bundle. It's too much stress.
Yeah, the bundle really ruined my account.
I'm sorry, weird game. I don't know. I don't want to play you.
Yeah, we've talked about this on previous cast. So yeah, my backlog is reaching like apocalyptic proportions here. Like, I'm going to need like the end of the world to have a chance to actually play all these games. And it really is crazy. That's another thing. Like, growing up playing games, again, I get to sound really old. I remember when games were $80 for a Super Nintendo title, and then that was it. You were going to buy the game, that was it for maybe 2-3 months. And today, yeah, I'm spending, $3 a day or, $8 a week on 2-3 different games that I may never even get to playing at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a weird world.
Yeah. And speaking about sales, here's another question for both of you that I also find really interesting. And that, as we just talked about, is sort of how video games have devalued, in a sense. Like, as we said, it's gone from $50, $60 to indie games being anywhere from $2 to $20. We got mobile games for 99 cents. How do you guys feel about that, being both gamers and developers, of how things have, the market has really shifted downwards in terms of pricing?
I think it's kind of frightening to see the pressure that's out there. Mm-hmm. We've, when going to conventions and speaking with other developers, I've heard, firsthand, it's like, we thought we'd release it for this amount, but everyone's telling us we have to make it cheaper, so we're going to make it cheaper. Or, we're going to make it free, and we'll figure out how to monetize it later. And, there's such a prevailing, stress to get the game really cheap, and then, also to bundle it. So just, get it in there. Who cares how much, it's always great to be on sale, so who cares? But I think that I hope that it balances out a little bit, and that there's, find a little bit of stability in there.
Yeah, it's kind of stratified a little bit, so you can see where the dollar games are, and you have people have a general understanding of what a dollar game is, and what a $15 game looks like, and less of an understanding, I think, of what a $40 to $60 game looks like. And so there has been sort of a congealing of understanding for that kind of stuff. But at the same time, you have to battle with just the perceptions of what your game looks like, because it's really easy to say, this game looks like iOS dollar game, whatever. And so that's definitely a message that you have to think about and battle against as you're promoting the game, as you're talking about the game. Mm-hmm. Talking to other developers who have had weird experiences like that, we've also talked to other developers who have to deal with piracy and that whole thing. And that a lot of that has to do with how people value the game. I think we're talking, I don't want to get the specifics on the who, but they said they sold a million copies over here, but it was pirated 3 million times. So you can't really say that your game is going to be immune to that ever, but promoting a higher value for your game is definitely something that's hard to do. It's hard to find that message. Like, our game is $15, but like people will say, why? Why isn't it just $8? Or I'll just wait till it's game sale. And it's weird to justify that. It's it's $15 because we put our heart and soul into it, and it's we want you guys to think of it as
I'm pretty sure it's worth $15. Game.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's exactly. Or more.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a weird balance to find.
I think it's just something to keep in mind. Just like we were talking earlier about focusing on old school, focusing on what that means. Also focusing on the value proposition of your game and making sure that you're being clear and consistent with it. Don't price it at this because you think that's what games are worth. Mm-hmm. And don't price it high because of that. Don't price it low because of that. Mm-hmm. Try to understand where you think your game falls, and stick to it and make sure that it meets that expectation or exceeds it, which is always better. It's definitely a scary thing.
Yeah, and I agree with you on that. I've talked about this on previous casts as well. And as I said, a few years ago, I was spending $50, $60 on games, they were a drop in the hat. because that was what we were expecting at that time. And today, it is just, it takes a lot for me to spend more than $15 on one game. Because as you said, the market has changed so much and we're being flooded with games. Like, you know, if your game is $20 and, you know, someone else just released a game for $8, why aren't you pricing your game at $8 too? And it's just really insane to see how this is really affecting game development and game sales. Like on a previous cast, I spoke to a game developer who they said that originally they were pricing their game at $25, $30, and they felt that that was too high, and they're actually happy that prices have devalued in a way so they can sell at $15, because they felt that's what it's worth. But I think you made a good point, Ian, about selling it at where you think is right is a good point. Like, don't sell too low, but also don't sell too high, because people are going to call you out on that. As an example, I was looking at the early access for Prison Architect, who they're selling it early access for $30, but they've said, you know, numerous times that it's going to retail for $10, $15, because that's what they felt, that's what the general market wants for it.
Huh. This is very strange, yeah. It's more like a supporting the developer kind of thing, it seems like.
And that actually takes me to one last question, at least for what I have for right now, before we get to Shovel Knight development, and that is on not so much on crowdfunding, but sort of like the early access craze, or being able to release games, you know, in alpha or beta, and then essentially getting paid while you're developing the game. This is another one of those really weird concepts, especially for you guys coming from console and handheld development, where, you know, you worked on a game for, you know, 2-3 years, and that was, you know, you were complete silence. No one was going to see the game. I mean, you joked earlier regarding, you know, the radio silence achievement or the goal, because that would have been great to be able to go back to that. But as we're seeing that the market has really shifted to more of an open, you know, transparency in terms of game development. So for both of you, what do you think about, you know, this early access or the sense that you're sort of developing the game as people are playing it, in a sense?
I think it's an interesting idea, but I don't think it's for every type of game. Mm-hmm. Especially after finishing a project like Shovel Knight, mm-hmm. we knew that the game is only at its best when everything's firing on all cylinders, mm-hmm. like the mobility feels right, like the weapons hang together, and the level is designed with all of those things I just said working properly. So if Shovel Knight was on early access, it would have been like, it would have been declared dead before arrival. Mm-hmm. Way, way before. So I think it's important to have a game that can be fun even with the broken fragments of it, mm-hmm. or it can be fun even like just because the base concept of it is so great to run around in, or like so great to experience. But that it's not for everyone. Mm-hmm. A console standpoint, especially in like the more closed development that we had in our previous, it's still the idea of developing a game where the code is live for somebody who's just like a casual observer is still a foreign concept to me. And so,
yeah,
I guess it depends on the type of game, but I wouldn't rule it out, and I wouldn't be in favor of it.
I'm not totally, yeah, convinced that it's the best thing for the the future of the game development, just in terms of like what it can do and how it's kind of affected. Like when you see an early access game, yeah, it's not always like, I think my favorite experience with an early access game was Minecraft, where it was like it's coming together and you're paying less to begin to jump in at alpha. I got it when it was like, you know, $15, mm-hmm. and it kind of came and grew with as you're playing it and the updates, and eventually they said, okay, now it's a done game. But a lot of times I see like very early, almost prototype, you know, what I would probably consider a vertical slice, where things just are ugly and they are not refined, and I have to look and I'm told to look past it because it's an early access. And I don't really like that trend of not focusing on polish and quality and stuff. So I'm not sure I'm totally sold on it yet, mm-hmm. but I'm sure it can be used in great ways and make sure that it can make an experience that gets people involved and makes them feel like they were part of the development.
It's tough though, because we look at, like, I play unfinished games every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I make games
that might be a huge,
because I exclusively work on games that aren't done.
Exactly.
And so because of that, it's difficult to get into that mindset of people that would be interested in that kind of thing. But I think it is the natural extension of transparent development, mm-hmm. for people to be able to just like boot up the game 1 week and see where it's at. But I'm not sure I've only seen like a few examples where I've been like really excited with how it's playing out. Like Nuclear Throne, that's like pretty cool what's happening there, which is every week they're doing the stream and they're updating it and they're like taking it, they're taking it places on like a very active schedule. But for just like a Kickstarter or just like a game that's going to be done in like 8 months, it seems like those early previews would only dampen the experience. Mm-hmm. Just my standpoint.
Well, yeah, it really tempers my expectations for what that game could be when I see, you know, like the collision just not working or like this massive bugs. It's like, will they get to this? And if they fix that, what does that mean? That like it's hard for me to get excited about the promise of what the game could be when there's just so many other things that are distracting me. So yeah, personally, it's hard for me to see past that stuff. And yeah, Ian's right. It probably has a lot to do with the fact that the only thing I do every day is look at old in progress games. But yeah, for the most part, I think that not putting a final quality polished product out there is not where I want to see it.
I think this also goes back to the tinkering stuff we were talking about. Mm-hmm. And just overall, when I weigh the two, I would rather have a complete experience that I could go through from start to finish than I would a fragmented one that I can tinker and learn about over time.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I think for me, I think leaning more towards Nick's opinion on early access. When I look on my Steam list right now, I have at least 4 games that I bought on there that are all early access, and I basically can't play them at this time because I'm afraid that if I, you know, sit down and dedicate, you know, what I would do like a regular game, you know, sit there and play for hours on end, I'm just going to burn myself out on what's considered the inferior version. And then when the game comes out, it's like, why should I play it now when I've seen everything, you know, 2-3 months ago?
Yeah, that's right.
And I think that's another good point that you said, Ian, that certain games I think work better towards it. Like something like Minecraft or an open-ended game, then it's a lot easier to play than something that would be linear. Because I can't see myself playing a linear, you know, game that's only supposed to be like a 5-hour experience and then playing it on early access.
Yeah.
That doesn't really make sense to me.
I think developers in the public know that too. That's why we don't see early access platformers, mm-hmm. but we see early access like open world exploration. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's what you're into.
And as a great case in point, another developer that I'm following, Gaslamp Games, they're doing a open like city builder game called Clockwork Empires, and they're announcing what they're dubbed earliest access, where you can play the game now, and things like version 0.6 something in alpha. And so there's that temptation to say, oh, it's a game that I really want to play, but do I really want to spend money now and, you know, basically have it sit in my library for, who knows, maybe 8 months or a year from now, and then, you know, play it. Sort of like opening up your Christmas present early, in a sense.
Right, yeah. I guess if you look at it like pre-sale that also comes with like something to play with, that's kind of cool. Mm-hmm. But it's just hard to look at it like that, you know?
Yeah. All right. I just remember one last industry question I really want to ask you guys, and then we will talk about Shovel Knight. And that is regarding the sort of shift in the how games are being put onto different platforms. Now, earlier we talked about sort of how PC gaming was going to die and then it came back. And we saw sort of how developers are moving to the PC platform, much like you guys are doing, how you move to Steam, how you move to digital distribution. Another trend that we're sort of starting to see some waves over is the reverse of that, the PC moving to the consoles. And one of the big names that's going around with that would be the Steam Box, and how Valve is trying to position a PC for the living room so that console gamers can play PC games, as you mentioned, Ian, earlier, that they don't have to deal with like the tinkering aspect. They can download the game, the box is completely, you know, self-contained, and they can play it that way. Once again, as developers who've made the move from console to PC, what are your thoughts essentially on the PC moving to the console?
It seems like a noble goal for sure. Mm-hmm. I've like checked in on the Steam Box, or at least big picture, and I like what I'm seeing, and I'd love to see it like represented as a standalone box. But it seems like, I mean, I was expecting that when Shovel Knight was out, that the Steam Box mm-hmm. would already be, like, at least in prototype form in some people's houses.
Yeah, we were talking about, like, maybe you're playing Shovel Knight on that weird Steam controller. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe somebody can do that, but...
But it seems like they're still going through, like, they're still trying to get it right. They're still, like, thinking mm-hmm. through it, going all in. And I guess they still have some challenges ahead of them. I think it would work well. It seems like having a library of games that work on a big TV just the same would be a nice fit. But like I want them to get the controller right so bad, and I want them to get being able to just press the power button and to turn on, like those two things where it's just like effortless needs to be done ever so carefully. If I ever have to go into an explorer mode to edit a text file to make my controller work or something, like just something terrible, then that illusion is shattered so quickly. So it's such a delicate process to make sure everything's handled ever so slightly.
All right, so with that, let's talk a little bit more about Shovel Knight's development and design. Because as we said, it's very interesting to be sort of like this retro-inspired game, but still using modern design sensibilities. So I guess my first question then in terms of development for Shovel Knight would be, in terms of development, we sort of touch upon, you know, old school difficulty at the beginning of the cast, but what was sort of the balancing act between making things too hard and trying to still deliver that old school flavor?
Yeah, we want, like we mentioned before, difficulty came up a lot, just in terms of everything has to be put under that lens of can the player understand this? Is this too convoluted or too complicated? Is this too difficult a task to ask the player to do? Especially with more modern gamers and the understanding of what a game is at this point in time, people aren't willing to start an entire game over because they failed a few too many times. And that's just one example. There's a lot there. And so there's been 30 years of learning of what makes a game difficult and what makes it fun. And so making sure that every, you know, new feature that we're adding is put under that lens of modern understanding was a very conscious and concerted effort throughout the whole project's design.
Now, in terms of development, now, obviously, we talked about some of the inspirations like Mega Man, Castlevania for Shovel Knight. Were there any like obscure titles for like the NES or SNES that gave you guys inspiration for Shovel Knight?
I mean, I would say not like exactly, like you can't trace it back and mm-hmm. think like, oh yeah, we did that just because of like Ice Climber or anything like that. But when we said that we were tapping into like our collective knowledge of the system, there were a lot of times where maybe a very small graphical trick or a very specific gameplay feeling was actually traced back to like an obscure game that we played, but like we didn't actually like go back and reference it. It's like a character needs to like appear in like magically and attack you, and like, okay, that would probably be like a fast flicker like this, like dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, oh, that's from like Blades of Steel or something on the NES. But like we didn't know that. We were just like, we were thinking like, what does an NES game do, or like what's the coolest NES game, like what is that? And it just like naturally, like that's what got plucked out of our brain.
Yeah, very often it'll be said, and while we're in the group setting, it's like, well, this reminds me of this. I can't think of it, but it looks like this. And then we like talk about what the actual specifics are, but we can never like place where that actually traces to, even in our own brains. So I would say there's probably a lot of games that that have influenced us, and some more obscure than others.
And to take it further, sometimes when we see people playing the game, like, I remember this was during King Knight's fight. He shoots the confetti and it like goes down with like sine waves left and right. And somebody played this at a convention and went, "Crystalis, nice." and I'm like, what are you talking about? It's like, Crystalis, a character would use a leap attack and it would like go just like that. And D'Angelo, who programmed the boss, I'm like, did you play Crystalis? He's like, maybe. It's like, is this from Crystalis? He's like, no, like I didn't think it was. Like I was just putting in a pattern that you had to dodge. Mm-hmm. But for somebody, they see that, and because of the heritage of the game, it just is like, oh yeah, like nice callback to Ghostbusters on NES. And it's like, wait, what? But that's kind of the fun part, because that means that there is like a common accepted language for the NES, or just an expected like visual design and gameplay design.
Yeah, and overall, I think that just means that we kind of fit. You know, we try to make the game not to directly reference a specific set of games, but more like feel like it existed as contemporaries to those games, in terms of its, you know, how you remember it and how it feels. So like we did solutions that were common at that time. So like the screen transitions is common in more than just Mega Man. Like it calls back to
any
Capcom game. And so it feels like that same flow. And so, you know, when you have elements that are maybe specifically referencing or feeling like they're referencing something, a lot of times it's just us trying to use the language that was available during that time of game development.
Okay. Now, regarding the art for Shovel Knight, this is one of my really stupid questions I'm curious about. And that is, in terms of actually mirroring the 8-bit style with Shovel Knight, in terms of doing that, did you, like, essentially work on a modern engine and develop it that way? Did you use, like, an older, you know, something that would have been seen on the NES and programmed Shovel Knight in that regard? Because I've heard stories, like, regarding, like, another old-school game, Etrian Odyssey, like, they use, like, an old, you know, 8-bit, you know, chiptune composer to develop the soundtrack. But for you guys, how did the art of Shovel Knight essentially come about?
Well, the art, as I was making the pixel art, I knew that we wanted to make it look like an NES game and it needed to feel that way. Mm-hmm. And there are a few components that make that work. One of the biggest ones is the palette from the NES days. Mm-hmm. So the palette that the NES could display was very limited and the same across all games. And it's a set of 64 colors where a large chunk of them are all the same black color. And so you end up with about 55 of the usable colors. And those colors comprise the majority of the game. And by doing that, you have a direct visual callback to those things. And so you see, you see the colors and you see, oh, okay, that's an NES game. And so that was a very effective way of doing it. We didn't really fall into this restrictions of how many sprites on screen at one time or even how many colors on screen at one time. We limited the amount of colors per character to like 5 or so, which is like what you would see in a Mega Man. But we wanted it to feel maybe like a high-end NES game, like, or an NES game made in the early 90s as opposed to the late 80s.
The only exception is, like Yuzo Koshiro's work on Etrian Odyssey, Jake used the NES sound chip to make all Shovel Knight's music.
Nice.
So that's authentic FSM or NSF sound format and could play on a traditional cartridge. And because of that, I think the game, like, well, by definition, is can't deviate too far from the NES, but can still, like, express creativity and, like, and things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, we actually, when we were at SuperCon a couple weeks ago in Florida, we met a guy who had put the soundtrack of Shovel Knight on a NES cart and was, nice. It was or a Famicom cart, and it was actually running on a Famicom. It was a 72-pin cart with the biggest one that was ever produced, and it was also emulating the VRC6 chip, which is the chip used for Castlevania 3 that's in Japan. If you ever want to see how that works, look at there's a comparison video online, I think, of listening to the soundtrack for Castlevania 3 in the American version and versus the Japanese version. And it's like this whole like dimension of sound that happens because it's literally another channel.
It's infuriating.
it's like, come on. the music is definitely good, but yeah. And then another thing we do is like that music is super authentic, but we never cut out a music channel for the sake of a sound effect. Mm-hmm. And so, it's super authentic, but not bound and restricted by the hardware.
Now, another big part of Shovel Knight's appeal in terms of that old-school sense is the pacing of the game. When you look at it, lengthwise, the game is only a few hours long, but it's a very quality few hours. In terms of developing, like, the content, did you guys have an original plan for we want the game to be, you know, something that could be played in 2 hours? Or did you go with, like, the kitchen sink approach and say, hey, we're going to make, you know, 30 different levels, and then we're going to cut it down to the very best?
No, at the beginning, we wanted Shovel Knight to be a run-driven game, which is, it's a game you play through in a sitting or two,
okay.
Similar to, like, a Mega Man or UN Squadron or something like that. We didn't want it to be, like, we weren't expecting it to be a grand, like, Zelda-style adventure where you log in each day and, like, make a little bit of progress.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted it to be, like, clear progress made each time, and maybe, like, the end goal would be that you could beat it all in one sitting.
Okay.
The game actually ended up a little bit longer than we expected, though, just with like the side nodes and some of the village exploration. But I think we hit a nice middle ground of being able to like just clear stages and do like traditional stuff, but also being able to like soak in the game and just be more of a part of the game's world.
Okay. Now, one other part of game design I need to ask you guys about in terms of the essential the boss designs. Now, you mentioned a few minutes ago the Royal Knight or the King Knight boss with like his type of design and how it was trying to mirror the old school design without being, you know, complete, you know, rip off or parody of it. in terms of designing the different knights, what kind of like design philosophy did you guys use or approach when coming with how this boss should be or how this guy should react and stuff like that?
I mean, we didn't approach the bosses with the idea being to call back to anything or to make it feel authentic. We approached it just like how I imagine a developer approached making a game back then, which is we already had the benefit of having strongly themed characters. So, like, this guy is like a king, so he's probably going to do things like strut around or, like, read a royal proclamation or, like, make somebody else do his work. This guy is, like, he's an underwater character, so maybe he has, like, an anchor or, like, a harpoon gun or something like that. So we took the theming and just designed the boss straight up around the same way we designed bosses for any other game, which is like, this is a quick character, like he's going to be tricky to like trap, to like nail down, or this is a projectile fight, he's going to put a lot of things on the screen, you have to dodge it, this is a pattern fight, or this is things like that. So I would say most of the design of the bosses came from their central theming, and was naturally extended there using NES like concepts or 2D platformer concepts.
All right. Now, another question I think would be very interesting, as we talk over this cast, how you guys are fans of old-school 2D design, you grew up playing them, you made them during your time at WayForward. With Shovel Knight's level design, or just general game development, were there any like levels or sections that you were particularly proud of or that you enjoyed the most in terms of developing them?
I guess the bosses are always really fun to do, because kind of going back to what we were just talking about, when you're designing the boss, you're thinking of the character, and you're thinking of what his personality is like, and you're thinking like what he could do, like what does a king do who's like, yeah, like Ian said, like he bosses guys around, or what does a ghost guy do? Maybe he summons skeletons. It's like all of those things are happening in a room all at once. So we're all throwing out ideas, writing them down on a whiteboard. We actually have some footage of this. Actually, we had our design sessions. Some of them were done over Twitch, and so if you were a backer on the Kickstarter at that level, you could join in and have conversations with us, and so we would talk about like the personality of Tinker Knight and what he's about, and like maybe he's a small guy, but he does a lot of silly things, and then he gets into, you know, phase two where he's big and giant robot. And like that all is really fun and really exciting for me.
The part I'm most proud of is probably the town and both towns and how the villages came together. Mm-hmm. We wanted action-packed stages, and we kind of assumed those were like a given. Like you'd fight, you'd like get health, and you'd reach the boss. But a town was not something we had a lot of experience with. So we wanted to make some place that had charm to it, that like was fun to run through, and also not a drag to run through multiple times. So that was like a process we naturally iterated on, and I'm pretty happy with where we landed, and I'd be excited to do stuff like that in the future.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, so I think with that, we're going to start wrapping things up for the cast. So I know that we've been going on for a while, and we could probably sit here and chat for the rest of the day. So I just have a few more questions just to conclude the cast, and then we will say our goodbyes. I guess the big question is, in terms of development for Shovel Knight, is the game like done in the sense that you're done working on it, or is there still more stuff you're planning on adding to it?
Lots more to do. I mean, first, the game isn't out yet in Europe or Australia, so that's a big focus for us. Second, when the 1.0 release of Shovel Knight that's out now included all of the Kickstarter content that affected the main campaign. Mm-hmm. So like, song scrolls are in there, achievements are in there, things like that.
New Game Plus.
Yeah, New Game Plus. However, there's a few other big modes like challenge mode or alternate playable boss nights that are their own feature that we are going to start working on soon. Those are going to be rolling out over the next couple of months in the form of free updates for everyone who owns the game. And I think that'll be a fun way to just kind of bring more Shovel Knight joy to anyone.
Awesome.
And once that's out, will the game truly be done?
Right.
Cool. Now, in terms of what's next for Yaha, are you going to work on a sequel to Shovel Knight, a completely new IP, or anything else?
At this point, we can only see those stretch goals that we're talking about. It's no small amount of work. So for the next year or so, and hopefully less, we'll be working on those major content updates. And after that, I don't know. Maybe we'll be sick of Shovel Knight. Maybe we'll want to move on. And I know that Sean really wants to do a 3D platformer. I think it'd be fun to do something totally different and maybe like figure out our online multiplayer. There's all kinds of directions that we could go, and ultimately it'll be up to what the team feels like it. So yeah, I could very well easily see us doing a direct sequel to Shovel Knight that uses the same engine, and I could also see us doing something completely different. But it'll be more down the line that we're starting to think about that kind of stuff.
All right, in that case, then, the final question for you guys is simply, for the folks who are listening to this who are both fans of Shovel Knight or your Kickstarter backers, do you have any final thoughts or something you'd like to say to them?
Well, if you're a backer, thank you so much for backing us and sticking with us from the beginning. It's been a long journey, and I'm really glad that it's kind of come to a spot where people can play the game and kind of see the fruits of their labors. And for those still waiting in the EU, like, we're working as hard as we can to get our game out there, and also in Japan and Australia. I guess anybody who's listening to this who has played it since and wasn't a Kickstarter, we can't be thankful enough to the reception that you guys have given us and just the level of support that we've gotten from you guys. In terms of just like keeping up to date and seeing all the information that we have out there, you can definitely follow our Twitter, you know, at Yacht Club Games. You can get the game over at shovelknight.com. And yeah, there's all kinds of ways to stay in touch with us. We will respond to your emails. We will try. There's a lot of emails to go over, but for the most part, we try to stay in contact with anybody who tries to contact us. So yeah, stay involved.
All right. So I think with that, we can end things for the cast. Nick, Ian, it was a pleasure talking to you today. And yeah, I love Shovel Knight, and I can't wait to see what you guys do next with it.
Well, thanks.
Thanks so much, Josh.
Yep.
Yeah.
Thanks for having
us on here. Yep, and hopefully we can talk again in a few months or whenever you guys have more free time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Right. Give us a ping whenever.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll be busy, but definitely.
I hope we have time in the future.
Well, we definitely will.
Yeah, all right, so for those of you listening, we're going to wrap the cast up for now. Thanks again for tuning in. As always, if you would like to contribute to Game Wisdom, there are several ways to do it. For those of you interested in either writing a guest piece or being a future podcast member, you can find information and links under Submissions 1 on the front page. And for those looking for more direct contribution, we are still doing a Patreon campaign to hopefully secure monthly funding for the site. And you can find all the information for that under our Patreon banner on the front page. So, thank you for tuning into the Perceptive Podcast. Have a great rest of the week or weekend by the time you hear this, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care, everybody.